Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
With all respect to members of the medical profession, it seems Congress has only now discovered how expensive healthcare is. As they dig into the various reform packages, lawmakers have developed a bad case of sticker shock. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Super Brands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Super Brands for more information. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. It is the 19th of June today. Great to have you here. House Democrats unveiled their version of how to fix the healthcare system today. That'd make it the third, or maybe it's the fifth, major plan floating around Capitol Hill. It's easy to lose track. What is not so easy to miss, though, are the price tags that these plans carry. For all the talk of reform in Washington lately, the Congressional Budget Office made it clear earlier this week that the talk is not going to be cheap, and the coverage everybody's talking about is not going to be enough. Tamara Keith explains.
The discussion on Capitol Hill has focused almost entirely on health insurance, how to cover the millions who are now uninsured, whether to require employers to provide it, whether to create a new government insurance plan. Charles Rangel of New York staked out the position of House Democrats this afternoon.
Is this going to bring down the cost of health insurance? You bet your sweet life. I can't wait to talk to anybody that's fighting against this public health insurance programs.
But you haven't heard much from Capitol Hill about health care this week. Most of the talk has been about how expensive insurance is, and not about why health care costs so much. This is surprising because cutting the cost of medical care is a priority for the Obama administration. A recent New Yorker article has been required reading at the White House. It explores the reasons health spending in one Texas city, McAllen, is higher than almost anywhere else, and people there aren't any healthier. Peter Orszag is Obama's budget director.
The package overall must also include a series of steps that will help to address the McAllen problem.
Those steps include things like changing the way hospitals and doctors are paid, rewarding quality of care rather than quantity. Orszag says legislation can address these issues within Medicare, which influences the entire industry.
They are the most auspicious set of proposals that we have to get towards a healthcare system that in which best practices aren't occurring only in isolated parts of the U.S., but are instead occurring throughout the U.S.
In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
When he wasn't talking health care this week, President Obama was all about financial reform, and we'll get to some of the finer points of what the president wants to do in our wrap later in the broadcast. But last night in New York City, Mary Shapiro, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, outlined some reform plans of her own. In particular, Shapiro said the commission wants to shed some light on a corner of the financial markets known as dark pools. Confused? Fear not. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on hand to explain.
When I hear the term dark pool, I can't help but think of the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Science couldn't explain it, but there it was, alive in the deep, deep waters of the Amazon, immensely strong and destructive.
For a proper explanation, I called up finance professor James Angel at Georgetown, who had this to say. Actually, Angel says, dark pools aren't that scary. They're really just a way for investors to trade big blocks of stock anonymously. In a normal stock exchange, everybody knows who's buying and selling. In a dark pool, you don't. Buyers and sellers send out secret messages. The dark pool acts as a matchmaker.
So this is a way that you can explain floor in the dark to see if you can find the other side of your trade without having to announce it to the entire world.
Why not announce your intent to buy or sell? Bill O'Brien is CEO of the electronic trading firm Direct Edge. He says if your mutual fund manager wants to make a big trade and everybody knows, that can cause huge swings in the price.
That might, you know, impact the market such that he has to wind up paying a lot more, or if he's selling, getting a lot less when getting that trade done.
Officials at the SEC worry all this secret trading in murky waters could cause suspicion and speculation in the public markets and deprive investors of information. But Georgetown's Angel says the SEC has more sinister things to worry about, like the next Bernie Madoff. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
As economists begin to at least consider the end of this recession, there's a new phrase that's starting to gain some traction. It's more familiar in a military context than economic, but it makes some sense if you think about it. Exit strategy, as in, how can the government work its way out of the extraordinary economic pump priming that's been going on for a year or more now? It'll be a topic of conversation when the Federal Reserve meets next week, and our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports that when to start that exit is the crucial question.
The Federal Reserve has essentially been stomping on the gas pedal to try to keep the economic engine from sputtering. Once that engine starts to run on its own, too much gas will cause inflation. The Fed has to know when to start hitting the brakes. Former Fed member Lawrence Meyer says the timing of that maneuver is tricky.
You can begin too soon and dampen the recovery, which needs to be very robust to bring that unemployment rate down. And, of course, you could tighten too late and have higher inflation as a result.
Meyer says the Fed has the tools to take money out of the system quickly when the time comes. It can call in short-term loans and raise interest rates. Some inflation-averse countries, like Germany, are already calling on the Fed to head for the exits. But others point to 1937, when the decision to tighten the money supply too soon after the Great Depression caused a recession. This year, there are no signs of an overheating economy, but Wesleyan University's Richard Grossman says figuring out when to ease up on the stimulus is an art, not a science.
Even if there is an uptick in economic activity, is that the beginning of the recovery that could be inflationary, or is that just a temporary blip and the next month the economic numbers won't look so good and we should therefore hold off on contractionary monetary policy?
In a speech earlier this week, Chicago Fed President Charles Evans said sometimes it takes more than good forecasting to know when to change policy.
You know, a little bit of good luck would be nice, too.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Nothing like good luck. On Wall Street today, the arrows were pointing every which way. Day three of a mixed market. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest iPhone went on sale this morning. The top-of-the-line version of the 3GS iPhone can be yours for $300, a little more than the equivalent of two shares of Apple stock at today's close. The iPhone is the leader of that pack by a mile, but Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports that even in the down economy, this is shaping up to be the summer of the smartphone.
Eugene Watson has been waiting in front of an Apple store in Los Angeles since 7 p.m. last night. Now it's 7 a.m., and the doors finally open.
I can go in now? Oh, hey, I love you guys!
The new iPhone 3GS isn't the only smartphone consumers have been cheering for. The BlackBerry Tour came out this week, the new Palm Pre was released earlier this month to great fanfare, and T-Mobile's new Sidekick hit the market in May. Telecom analyst Jeff Kagan says only about 10% of cell phone users have a smartphone now, but
the traditional cell phone part of the industry is actually slowing. The smartphone segment is exploding.
Kagan says smartphone sales are growing 25% a year and will make up two-thirds of all new phone sales by the end of 2009. But wait, aren't we in the middle of a recession? Smartphones can cost hundreds of dollars. Then there's the real expense, the service contract. Calls, texts, internet, the latest apps can run more than $100 a month. Josh Martin is a senior analyst with the Yankee Group. He says something's got to give.
Eventually, consumers are going to have to say, I can't spend $400 or $500 a month on, you know, supporting my devices.
iPhone blog editor Renee Ritchie says people might scale back on downloading music, kill their landline, even cut back on their cable, but they will not do without their smartphones.
I think they're becoming increasingly a necessity. Now your instant messages, everything can be popping up at you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Ritchie says now that smartphones have made it possible, we're all expected to be on call around the clock. Employers want to be able to reach their employees at will. Clients expect immediate attention. Friends feel snubbed if you don't text them back right now. At the Apple store in Los Angeles, Noah Saul and Drake Kemper emerge from the store with their new acquisitions.
I'm so happy. You know, this is as happy as I can get right now. I'm about to take the screen off. There we go.
Noah is barely out the door, but he has his phone synced up, and he's ready to let the world know.
I'm going to right now do my official Twitter. What should I type?
First ever tweet from a 3G app.
Ever tweet on iPhone 3GS.
Yeah. Send.
Woo!
We just made history right there.
But sometimes history has to leave a message.
Calling my dad with it. And he's not going to pick up.
First ever non-picked
voicemail.
Up call. First voicemail. Ever voicemail from the 3G speed.
First ever screened call. At the Apple Store in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you had to take this week and boil it down to just one word from the Dictionary of Finance, it would probably be this. Regulation. New rules for how Wall Street does business. The president has some ideas on that, as he shared with us on Wednesday. To share our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got financial writer Heidi Moore with us, as well as Megan McArdle from the Atlantic Magazine's Business Channel. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai. Thank you.
Thanks for having us back.
All right, so Heidi, you get to go first this week. The president said in announcing his new financial regulations that what we're seeing is the greatest overhaul of the financial system since the Great Depression. True, not true?
It could be true when it actually happens, but nothing's happened yet. What we've seen is a white paper on financial reform, which means that all of these are just very strong suggestions. And the test of it is going to be in what the Congress does with it over the summer.
Megan, let me ask you this. Since you are actually in Washington, you'll be obviously, you know, looking at this stuff as it goes through the summer. Does what's in these regulations meet, you know, the problem that we had?
No, this doesn't actually prevent the kind of overleverage and interlocking that brought down the financial system last November. It's not really clear to me, at least, whether there is an ideal regulation out there that would do that, but it's pretty clear that this regulation doesn't.
The other thing about regulation that you have to watch, though, is, and Wall Street is watching this too, is that a lot of our regulatory system has always been built on this idea of silos, right? So the stock markets were regulated one way, the bond markets another way, credit derivatives a third way. And that was fine when all of those markets were separate. But now they're basically all the same. You have the same players trading stocks, trading bonds, trading credit derivatives. And you really need regulators who can work across all of those platforms to understand what's going on. And that is definitely not happening with these reforms.
All right. Well, now that we've had the meta argument, let me ask you about a couple of specifics. Megan, first of all, to you and the Federal Reserve as the lord of all its surveys, the Uber regulator, what do you think?
I think that it's hard to see who else could fulfill that role. Ultimately, if you gave someone else the kind of power outside of the Fed that some of the critics have been advocating, you would simply end up with internecine warfare that would do worse damage to the financial system than it's suffered already. And ultimately, if we had another crisis, that regulator would have to stop and wait to see what the Fed did.
But doesn't the Fed already sort of have its hands full, what with, oh, I don't know, monetary policy and figuring out interest rates and liquidity and all that stuff, Megan?
I think that these are really tough questions. England has a unitary executive, and that didn't keep them from having these problems. We had a fragmented system, and we also fell prey to overleverage and systemic risk.
One last question, you guys, before I let you go, and it goes something like this. Is there a limit to how much we can regulate Wall Street before it can't do what Wall Street is supposed to do, which is in part get money and liquidity and cash into the system so that the rest of us can make money? Heidi?
Yeah, there is definitely a limit at which you can regulate Wall Street without completely crushing innovation. The problem is we're nowhere near that limit. I mean, we have plenty of more room for regulation if it's properly executed. Right now, the street is very lightly regulated. A lot of people don't think that the problem is that the street is lightly regulated, that the problem is that the street is badly regulated, that people are not as careful in the regulatory agencies as they should be, that they don't have as much expertise as they need. So if you can fix that, then you don't really need a lot more regulation or different agencies. You can have better agencies of the kinds we already have.
Megan, your thoughts?
There is room to regulate more, and there's certainly room for better regulation. And one of the areas that people really want to look, and almost everyone agrees, is at leverage and how much risk we allow each firm to take on within its balance sheet.
How much borrowing.
Right. That said, you know, there's a big cost to this. The more that you sort of tamp down on the banks, the more difficult it is for them to allocate capital efficiently. And risky vehicles for capital allocation have in the past helped to build industries like, for example, the telecom industry, which was largely built on the back of junk bonds. So entirely eliminating it, which can seem tempting in the wake of these sorts of things, can have bad consequences down the road in terms of your economic growth.
Heidi Moore, Megan McArdle, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.
Coming up, one way to decide whether ancient sculptures really belong one place.
These sculptures were created for the light of Athens, and that's why this is the best way to show them under that light.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street kept up its fickle ways. Today, the Dow Industrials lost 15 points, not quite 0.2%, closed at 8,539. The NASDAQ gained 19 points, 1%, settled at 1827. The S&P 500 notched up 2 points, almost a third of 1%, wrapped up trading at 921. It was, though, a losing week overall. The Dow gave back 3% since Monday. The NASDAQ slipped 1.7%. The S&P 500 lost 2.7%. Tech shares were one of the market's bright spots today. Apple, as we told you, released a new iPhone. Its stock rang up 2.2%. Rival Microsoft deposited nearly as much, 2.4% after Goldman Sachs added the software maker to its buy list. Chipmaker Intel eked out a rise of 0.8%. Falling crude tanked energy shares down below $70 a barrel. ExxonMobil and Chevron slid 0.5%. Oil-filled services provider Schlumberger lost nearly 0.75%. Bond prices rose and set the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.77%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In San Francisco, First Lady Michelle Obama speaks at the National Conference on Volunteering and Service. Wimbledon opens in London and runs through July 5th, but it looks like knee problems will prevent Rafael Nadal from defending his title. And award-winning actress Meryl Streep turns 60. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Now that it's through Congress, a $106 billion spending bill to pay for Iraq and Afghanistan through the end of the fiscal year is headed to the White House. The president is expected to sign it. Washington being Washington, though, war spending is not the only thing that's in that package. Among many other things, it also contains what has become known as the Cash for Clunkers plan, up to $4,500 to get people to trade in their old gas guzzlers for newer models that get better mileage. It should be a boost to struggling car dealers and anybody who wants a new compact or a hybrid, I suppose. But what about what you might call the clunker economy, businesses that depend on those old cars? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Many charities count on donated cars as a steady revenue stream. I asked Stacy Palmer of the Chronicle of Philanthropy what happens if a 250,000 clunkers get traded in instead.
It definitely will be more difficult.
Though, in fact, Palmer says the flow of cars was running dry before Cash for Clunkers came along.
Charities have already seen a drop-off in the number of cars being donated in the recession. People are still looking for ways to get some kind of cash rather than the value of the charitable deductions.
So if charities won't benefit from this, maybe junkyards will. Michael Wilson stops me right there.
We refer to it as the J word.
Wilson's head of the Automotive Recyclers Association. That's what auto salvagers like to be called these days. He says, sure, his members will have plenty of old cars to strip down and sell, but...
You've got vehicles that are out there in the marketplace already. When you get a mad rush, you know, of upwards, let's say it's 150,000 vehicles over a couple-month period, you may already have that inventory on your shelves.
In other words, they may already have enough car parts on hand, so a lot of these vehicles may end up crushed for scrap metal. But there's a glut of that right now as well.
The market really dropped off last October. They were getting around $300 a ton, and it's dropped back down to about $120.
So that means wreckers and scrap metal processors aren't likely to make off like bandits either. Perhaps the biggest beneficiaries will be car makers and car dealers, which is the whole point of the exercise to begin with. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Athens, Greece is set for a major cultural happening this weekend. A brand new museum is going to be opening at the foot of the Acropolis tomorrow. At the top of that hill, you can find a number of significant historical monuments, including the Parthenon Temple. What you can't find there, though, is something the Greeks would very much like to have in their new museum, the other half of a set of marble sculptures from the Parthenon. The sculptures, the reason the new museum was built, are now sitting in the British Museum in London, which is where Christopher Worth begins our story on the continuing controversy over what are called the Elgin Marbles.
The British Museum draws an average of 6 million visitors every year. They marvel at Egyptian mummies, giant statues of the pharaohs, and from the Greek Empire, the marble sculptures that British diplomat Lord Elgin cut from the Parthenon 200 years ago. Here's curator Ian Jenkins.
The Parthenon was built between 447 and 432 BC, at the time when Athens was the most powerful Greek city in the Mediterranean, the head of an empire.
By the early 19th century, Greece was part of the Ottoman Empire, centered in Istanbul. Lord Elgin, the British ambassador to Turkey, got permission to cut down the sculptures. He wanted them to spruce up his family seat in Scotland, but he went bankrupt with the cost of shipping and sold the lot to the British government. Greece has been trying to get them back ever since. But the British Museum says no. Christopher Price is a former member of Britain's Parliament who wants the Elgin marbles returned.
The argument changes every 10 years or so. First, they were, you know, it's impossible to move, too heavy to move, and that sort of thing. Then the Greeks couldn't look after them. They couldn't look after anything. And then this project for a new museum next to the Acropolis took shape, and now it's complete.
The new air-conditioned museum at the Acropolis recreates what the Parthenon looked like as a whole. It uses what was left behind in Athens and fills in the missing parts with plaster casts of the sculptures in London.
The differentiation shouts at you. It really hurls at you. And everybody from the world will, on leaving the museum, say, where are the rest of them? And they'll say, well, they're in the British Museum.
Price says that should put pressure on the British Museum. But Hannah Bolton, a museum spokesperson, says she doesn't envision them ever leaving.
We feel very strongly that actually there's huge advantage to having the sculptures in two different places, because here in London they can tell this worldwide story. In Athens they can tell a different but complementary and important story about ancient Athens and its place in ancient Greece.
Spiros Diamantis, a spokesperson for the Greek government, isn't convinced. He says it took just one visit to the British Museum to make up his mind.
It was a cloudy day. It was miserable, to say the truth. These sculptures were created for the light of Athens, and that's why this is the best way to show them under that light.
The new Athens Museum expects 2.5 million visitors this year. Diamante says that number could double if the sculptures are returned and bring in welcome tourist dollars at a time when Greece is hurting economically. But directors of the British Museum fear a return could set a precedent. If these sculptures go back to Greece, when would the Egyptians or denizens of other ancient empires come knocking on the door? In London, this is Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that it is a Friday afternoon, and as such, we're going to let Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan loose with their survey of the news of the week that didn't make it onto the big broadcast. You know, something you might talk about at a dinner party.
Amy Scott, New York Bureau Chief, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, hard times have prompted several counties in Michigan to turn some of their paved roads back into gravel.
Is that safe?
I don't know if it's safe, but it's cheap. Apparently, it costs about 10 times more to repave a road than to just tear it up and put down gravel. And, you know, some of these counties are broke, so...
Oh, man.
It's kind of sad.
But on the other hand, it's like, why not, right? The companies that made cars for the roads have also turned to gravel.
Bill Radke, host of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to talk about?
Okay, so near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, this Vietnamese immigrant, John Pham, says, hey, if you've lost a job in this recession, come to my restaurant. I'll give you a bowl of pho, which is Vietnamese soup, for one penny.
That's so generous of him.
Exactly.
Here's the thing, though. With pho in particular, they give you a bowl of broth and this pile of other stuff. You actually have to work for your soup. Like, you're like tearing basil leaves.
It's true. It's not a handout at all, is it? You actually burn more calories sorting through pho than you get taking it in. True story.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter, what is your story this weekend?
Boston sold Christmas.
To Harvard?
No. Boston normally has this 8,000-foot enchanted village that it sets up, but it doesn't have the money to do that, so it auctioned it off.
What is going on? Like, Michigan destroyed its roads to save money. Now Boston is selling Christmas. What other nice things can we get rid of? Like, is Vermont going to sell its fresh mountain air?
Los Angeles could buy that, except we don't have any money.
That's all right. We'll sell Keanu Reeves.
There's a link to Rico and Brendan's full podcast, the Dinner Party Download, at our website. It's marketplace.org. And on this Friday afternoon, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 15 points, a tenth percent. The Nasdaq gained 19 points, about a percent. The S&P 500 scooted up 2 points, a third of 1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. Is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the tab for lunch, $650,000. A chance with Warren Buffett, priceless.
It just so happens that my hero is alive, and my hero actually is willing to accept a bribe to sit down for a meal.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul to Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul to Story are available now.